And what I will do with Shmuel Bet can be done with Sefer Bereshit, can be done with Sefer Yirmiyahu, can be done with Masechtos. And basically it is to take that which is familiar to you and associate it with things that are unfamiliar. Right now, the topics of Shmuel Bet you may have some familiarity more with some parts of the Sefer than with others. Hopefully with this list, not that I'm going to ask you to remember all 24 words, but there will be ways that if you look at this list afterwards, you will be able to remember this. The content of the Sefer. I have played this trick with campers at Camp Marashah and Camp Misora, and many of them come even 20 years after I'd worked this trick with me, and they say that one of these fancy words, and they say the word, and they say what the content of the chapter is. And certainly my 7th grade class at Manhattan Day School, which I had for 10 years, where we memorized the contents of the Sefer using these 24 words, they like to gloat that they can still do it 15 years later. The fact is, we all have a camera in our minds. We all have a photographic memory. We all know what a quarter looks like. We all know what our home looks like. We all know our address and telephone number. If we pay very close attention to things and it enters our mind in a way where the mind grabs it and takes hold of it, then we will we'll do a better job of remembering things. The problem is that our minds are always competing with things. Everybody in this room has something that in the family or some kind of peccala, some kind of worry or bother or distraction. Texting is a big one. If our minds are competing with something else, it will affect our ability to remember the thing that we are being told. So I ask you to shut the phones, don't text. If there's something you can do at the same time, like eat or crochet, that doesn't take much of your mind away from what you're listening to, then you will still be able to remember this. And get from the hour what we're supposed to. So my hour starts now. See a list of 24 words. I will connect them to the 24 chapters of Shmuel Bet, which begins with the death of Shaul. This death is recorded at the end of Shmuel Aleph, that Shaul fell on his spear. And he took his own life for fear of what the Philistines would do to him if they caught him alive. Philistines were not good captors. They tortured to death, especially people in a high position. Remember what they did to Shimshon? If they caught Shaul alive, they would rip him apart publicly. Shaul feared this, and according to Chazal, justifiably took his own life, especially since he believed, whether this woman was actually performing something that was true or not, he believed that a witch, a necromancer that he had visited, back in chapter 28 of Shmuel Aleph, told him, tomorrow you will die. Whether or not that woman was telling the truth, or whether she had someone under the table making Shaul think she was telling the truth, Shaul believed this to be the case, so he took his own life, fell on his spear, and that's how Shmuel Aleph ends. Shmuel Beis begins the first chapter with an Amaleki, a great irony, because Shaul didn't do the job of finishing off Amalek, an Amaleki convert. An important point for another time, but the Tanakh refers to him as a convert from Amalek. Rashi in his Perush to Sefer Yeshayahu says Amalekim may convert men and women right away, but Ammon and Moab may not. It's another shir, but Amalekim may convert. I admit that is not a universal opinion. Rashi holds that opinion. That Perek Aleph says a convert from Amalek came to David with Shaul's crown and hand bracelets, and said, "This belongs to the King Shaul." David asks him, "How did you come to get it?" And he says, "Because I came." Now in Shmuel Aleph it says that Shaul fell on his spear. The boy is asked for further explanation, how did you kill Shaul? And he said, because he was leaning on, and he says, his sword. It doesn't say spear, but in Shmuel Bet, he says he was leaning on his sword, and I came up to him, and he said, listen, I'm bleeding to death. I tried to take my life. I asked his armor bearer to finish him off, and he couldn't, so he fell on his own, and Shmuel Aleph's spear. Here the boy is telling me he fell on his sword, and He was bleeding to death, and he begged me, please finish me off so that I'm dead when the Philistines make it here. David hears him and apparently does not believe him. I can prove from chapter 4 when we get there that David does not believe he's telling the truth. But he does have the king's crown and bracelets. How did he come to this? It's a little complicated to show, to prove that David thought he was lying, but when we get up to chapter 4, you'll hear. Right? David kills the boy. It's called a na'ar in the text. Rashi says he was actually Doeg Ha'adomi. How we connect that is complicated, but David kills him on his own admission, and the Radak says he killed him based on David's power as king. Killed him extrajudiciously. The law is you can't kill someone based on their own testimony. But David took his life, and David says, for bragging for killing the king. The death of Shaul is actually good news for David. Now he's the indisputable king of Israel. So it's almost like what the Gemara at the end of Brachos says, when you hear, Chas v'Shalom, that a parent dies and you're about to inherit a lot of money, the Gemara says you make two Brachos. One, Dayan Emes, for the loss. Two, Shechiyonu v'kimonu 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 for the windfall. I'll leave it to the poskim to discuss when that second Bracha should be made. But the death of Shaul is very good news for David. As other pieces of news in the beginning of Shmuel Bet, but here's your vocabulary word. David nonetheless acts in a doleful manner. He rips his clothing, he starts singing a dirge at the end of the perek, which enters some of our liturgies, especially the Av HaRachamim prayer that we say on Shabbos morning to bemoan the loss of Jewish communities to the Crusades. A lot of the psukim, take a look, compare the two, come from David's dirge that he sings for Shaul and his three sons. Right, so it's actually good news for David that now he is king, but because the boy was gloating over it and thought that I will get more of a reward from David for presenting him the crown and the bracelets of his enemy, that David killed him. It was crucial for David to show all of Israel that he is not happy with the death of Shaul, but more importantly, as some Achronim point out, remember, where was David at the end of Shmuel Aleph as Shaul was being killed? David was living with the Philistines for some time. Twice he was living with the Philistines. In between, he went to Moab. There was no place to go in Israel. David couldn't flee to an Israelite town, because wherever any Israelite town that helped him would get destroyed, like the town of Kohanim, of Nov, back in Shmuel Aleph. So David had no place to go. He even had to take his family out of Israel to bring them to Moab, because Shaul would use his family as hostages and said, kill them one by one unless you give yourself up. So David has spent quite a bit of time living amongst the Philistines, and here the Philistines find the king's hideout and kill him. The word might have spread out in Israel that David colluded with the Philistines in order to kill King Shaul and get in power himself. Now that would be terribly wrong, of course, but you know, people talk. So David has to show everyone, I am not happy with the death of Shaul, and he acts in a very doleful manner. Remember, his best friend Yonatan was also killed here. So, but David sings this dirge not just for Yonatan, he sings it for Shaul as well, and that is the topic of chapter 1. Chapter 2 is now that David is crowned king, the problem is that he's not crowned king of all of Israel. Avner, Shaul's chief armor bearer, appointed Shaul's son to be king. It's a bad decision. Everyone can see, as you'll see with a picture of Ishbosheth, the name of Shaul's son, that you'll see in chapter 4. Ishbosheth is not good material for kings. So why would Avner, a seasoned general, he knows what's best for Israel, why would he appoint Ishbosheth? So there are a few reasons. One, he's his cousin. Two, he wants to be loyal to the first king, Shaul. Three, as Tosfos in Sanhedrin points out, that there was an oracle that two kings must rule from Shaded Binyan. Tosfos judges Avner because the Gemara at the end of the fourth paragraph of Masechet Sanhedrin does very much. And he says that Hashem told Yaakov, Umelochim mechalatzecha yitzeyu, at the end of the fifth Aliyah in Parshas Vayishlach, and the There are two kings. Melachim must yet come from a child unborn. And Binyamin wasn't born at that time. Melachim mechalatzecha yetzeu mechalatzecha. So that's Shaul and Ishbosheth. So Ishbosheth is now king over the 11 tribes, and David only rules over Yehuda. It's not over the whole kingdom yet. So the two sides behave in a competitive manner, and they have a game. It says, Ve'akumu l'sachek. It started off as a game. 12 against 12. The Tanakh does not describe the nature of this game. It's just dependent on the commentaries. The Radak say that says that the purpose of this competition was to show the tribes which side is better capable of defending the people, the nation, from the Philistines. This competition took on a violent streak to it. It apparently was not meant to be violent. It was 12 men from David's side, 12 men from Shaul's side, with some kind of war game. It might be a capture of the flag, I don't know. Some kind of war game where a lower person on David's side, Asael, his nephew, chased after the captain of Shaul's, of Ishbosheth's side, Avner himself. Avner told him three times, turn away from me, I'm too big for you to capture. As if though there has to be some kind of tag here, I don't know, that you go to a box where you're put into a... it doesn't describe what the game is. It just says that Avner keeps telling him, turn to the right, turn to the left, chase after someone else. I'm too big for you. I'm not worthy for you to chase after. Chase after one of the other 11. And Asael keeps pursuing him. It says that he was as quick as a deer. And at one point, Avner says, apparently right before he was going to be caught, he turned around, held on to something sharp that Asael ran into so quickly. And it says it went between his fifth and sixth rib and immediately killed him. And Asael was drenched in blood. The blood spurted all over the place, and all of the combatants saw all this blood and turned the tide of this competition, with all the spectators joining in, until by the time this was finished, it looked like the worst soccer match in Europe that you can imagine. 380 people killed as part of a game, a competition that was just meant to show who has better forces. But of those 380, 360 from Shaul's side and 20 from David's side. And everybody saw from this competition, from this competitive game, that David's side was unequivocally better at serving the people. In chapter 3, Ishbosheth can read the tea leaves. He sees things are not going well for him. And somehow, what made him do it, he must have been telling the truth. Somehow, Ishbosheth accuses Avner of wanting to marry a former wife of Shaul. Her name is mentioned. She's called Rizpah Bas Aya. Remember the name. She will appear at the end. It's 45 minutes from now, I'll ask you to remember the name. Rizpah Bas Aya is a former wife of Shaul, and by wanting to take a former wife of a king, that's another way of saying you want to be king. Think of Macbeth, think of Hamlet, think of Haman, Ahasuerus was basically telling Haman, Hakovesh es hamalchus im babayis. The way the Gemara presents what Ahasuerus was thinking Haman wanted. You want the queen, you want the kingdom. So Avner tells Ishbosheth, listen buddy, if I wanted to be king over the 11 tribes, I could have crowned myself, and people would have considered me the second king from Binyamin. I crowned you out of loyalty to your father. I don't need this. I'm going over to David's side. Which is great news for David, but very bad news for Yoav. Yoav is Asael's older brother. You'll remember him very well from Shmuel Bet, in the later stories. And Yoav hates Avner for a number of reasons. It's very bad for Avner to go to David's side as far as Yoav is concerned. One, you killed my brother! Two, Avner is a much, much more seasoned general than Yoav is. Avner will take Yoav's place. Three, Yoav goes to David and says, how can you think of allowing Avner to come to our side? He's the one who crowned you. If not for him, you'd be king of all 12 tribes now. How could you allow him to come to our side? In chapter 3, Avner behaves in a conciliatory manner and is willing to bring the entire kingdom over to David's side. And he can. He has the power to do so. But Yoav accuses him of subterfuge. Yoav tells David, you don't want Avner. Avner is just coming to your side to be a double agent. He wants to see your weaknesses, and his first chance he gets, he'll kill you and bring all 12 tribes back to atrocious. The reader has a sense that this is not true. But David agrees, you're right, I'll test him. What's the test? Bring me Michal. What does that mean? You can imagine, David, remember, was married to Shaul's daughter, his best friend is Shaul's son. Right? When David was persona non grata in the kingdom, in the palace anymore, the last time he knew that it was never safe for him to be near the palace was when she let him out the window, remember? And he set her free. When he came back in the morning to try to kill him in bed, there was like a dummy in bed like you made from when you went on a raid in camp when you wanted the council to think he was still there in bed. So that's what she made for David. And shortly afterwards, David realized he couldn't come to the palace. That's the Haftor of Mocha Chodesh with the arrows, where, remember that, where, with Yonatan. So at that point, Shaul gave Michal to another man. Chazal think very highly of that man. His name is Palti ben Laish. Why would they think highly of him? Because, the Gemara says, never went near her. Palat Bekel, it says Palti ben Laish is his name. He never went near her. He said, this is a married woman. Yeah, but the king says you have to stay married. All right, so he went behind closed doors. Remember, Zerah Siyuch and Penuya wasn't yet, for those who know what that means. But the point is that Michal was given to another man at this time. So David says, this has been many years since then. He says, all right, Avner, you want to be on my side? You want to be conciliatory? Bring me Michal. It's very smart of David to do this. Start judging this way. He loves her. He wants his wife back. But two, Ish-bosheth does not want Michal to go to David, because that would solidify the kingdom. If Michal goes to David, that's another nail in Ish-bosheth's coffin. If Avner can deliver me Michal, that's a sign that he is not trying to help Ish-bosheth by coming to see that Yoav is wrong. You understand? And Avner delivers. David gets his wife back. It's a very important point of solidifying David's kingdom. Right? So, forget it, that just goes right into the next word. Regicide means the killing of a king. Right? C-I-D-E is killing, and then you put whatever word you put before, whether it's suicide, homicide, patricide, fratricide, matricide, whatever word. Regicide from R-E-G, reign comes from this word, regulation, regular things, so that all come from the Latin word for king. So Ish-bosheth is killed in chapter 4 because there's no protection. Avner is not on his side. Michal is not on his side anymore. So two relatives of his from Sheva Binyamin, Rechav and Ba'ana, make their way into the palace by killing some wheat deliverers. And they come up, they show the list. Oh, you have a delivery of wheat. Okay, come on in. Once they're in, fascinating, the Bible refers to them in feminine. It says, Hain, with a nun. Men get a mem. They get a nun. So, it's fascinating. I mean, the Radak points out, they got the king's head to present to David, thinking that David would be happy with the death of the man who's standing in his way for being the king of all of Israel. So you can ask, how did men get the head of the king outside of a palace? How they got in, the Bible tells us. How do you get the head of a king outside the palace? There must be guards at every door. Can you guess? What did they say about the pronoun? Okay, you got it. All right, so they left the palace as a pregnant woman. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, continue your breakfast, please. Okay, so that's chapter 6. Oh, it gets even worse. All right, so at this point, this is where we know that David didn't believe the Amaleki in chapter 1. Because when they present the head, he says, here is the head of your enemy! His father tried to kill you! Right, so David says, how could you possibly think that I want the death of Ish-bosheth? Back earlier, when someone was just an informer, and I didn't believe that he was. This is one of the 10 Kavachomers in Tanakh. I didn't believe he actually killed Shaul. He was just informing me of something. And I killed him for it. How much more so will I kill you because it's obvious from your actions that you actually killed a man? From those words, it's very clear that David did not believe that that boy actually killed Shaul, or in any way took his life. All right? He was just bragging and thinking that with anyone who thinks that David is happy with the death of Shaul or Ish-bosheth will be dispatched by David. You can ask back in chapter 2, how is Avner so foolish as to allow himself to be in seclusion with Yoav for even a moment? Surely you know that Yoav wants you dead. If at the very least, because you just killed his brother in chapter 2 when you were competitive with them, right? So there, it's possible, as you'll get used to seeing what Yoav is like, that Avner was sure that if Yoav would do anything harmful to me, everyone in Israel would attribute that to David. That David had me killed after I delivered his wife. Right? So David, not wanting anyone to think that either, even sings a much greater dirge at the death of Avner. Right? I judge David b'kavzchus at the death of Avner back in chapter 3, when Yoav killed Avner. Right? Yoav kills Avner in chapter 3. Right? And David sings a dirge at the death of Avner also. The last pasuk in chapter 3 is, and all of Israel knew that David did not send Yoav to kill Avner. Right? So now David, that now chapter 5, Avner is gone, Ish-bosheth is gone, Shaul is dead, and the other son of Shaul is dead. I am now ready to be, word 5, imperial. Imperial just means that in chapter 5, all of Bnei Israel come to David and say, we realized even when Shaul was alive that you were better material to be king than Shaul. David could be forgiven for saying, really? So why didn't you ever tell that to the king when he was chasing after me all those times? All right, but still, all now representatives of all 12 tribes went to David and said, you are our king. In chapter 5, he is crowned for the first time king over all of Israel. Right, for the first 7 years of his kingdom, he ruled in Hebron, and in chapter 5, he moves his kingdom to Jerusalem, and the Malbim says for a beautiful reason, Ki'ir shechubra lo yachdav. Hebron is in the heart of Yehuda, Yerushalayim is on the border of Binyamin. The first kingdom was from Shevet Binyamin. David says, I want my kingdom to be, this is a fascinating reason to bring to Jerusalem. You all heard of all kinds of other reasons why Jerusalem was known from before, but according to the Malbim, it was a political reason to make Binyamin feel more part of the kingdom. So let them feel that I'll take some of them into my cabinet, perhaps, whatever it might be. And this is what happens when David behaves in an imperial manner. There is a fascinating dichotomy between two nations in chapter 5 that react to David becoming king. The Plishtim go to war with him, and the people from Tsor, that's from what Lebanon is now, Tyre, Sidon, the king of Tsor, his name is mentioned, Hiram, and he has a good idea for how a new king as powerful as David can help him. He's going to have to build a palace, he's going to have to build a temple. What do they have in Tsor that would be good for those things? They great cedars, and let me make a peace pact with him, and that was a friendship that lasted for hundreds of years. In fact, when David was rebuffed from building the temple in chapter 6, chapter 7, Hiram was still rewarded because David's son, Shlomo, built the temple with those cedars from Hiram many years later. Okay? But we're still in chapter 5, the Plishtim went to battle with David in places that you will all recognize in Jerusalem. In Mikrefa'im, the whole area between Harabais and Rehov, Derech Hebron, Derech Beit Lechem, all these battles, this battle takes place, and David routed the Plishtim, and you never hear from them again. That's it. All this problem with Plishtim for a few hundred years. In Sefer Shoftim, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, after they react this way, just as fascinating that David becomes king, and two nations, one to the south, the Plishtim, and one to the north, react in exactly the opposite way. Tsor says, let me make a peace pact. This is a good king. It's good to be in a good way with him. And the Plishtim, what drove you to do this? I could just say the same thing. I think when Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, Yisro sees everything. Baruch Hashem, Asher Yitzil Hashem, Dei Mitzrayim. And Amalek, exactly the opposite way. They were one right next to the other. Amalek is the end of Bishalach. Right away, Yisro, a different reaction. 12 Meraglim see the same thing. 2 say this, and 10 say this, and alter the course of history in the desert. It's just there are none so blind as those who will not see. And that's what happens to the Plishtim, and David wipes them out, and now he's ready to be imperial. There is an impediment, though. As David builds Yerushalayim, the next step is to take that Arom that was taken from the Israelites at the beginning of Shmuel Aleph. Remember that Eli's two sons took the Arom to battle, and the Philistines took it into captivity. While it didn't last in the land of the Philistines for too long, it was for 20 years in the house of a particular man. His name was Aminadav. And it remained there for so long that David says, why shouldn't we have it in a special place? Right? Mm. It's not in a Mishkan, it's in someone's private house. So David says, well, now that I'm building my capital city, I want the Aron in that capital city. But there's a terrible impediment to bringing that Aron there. On its way, while he was traveling, that man, Aminadav, was in his house for so long, the house was blessed for so long, he had this chus of walking in front of the Aron, and his two sons on the two sides of it. One was named Achio, one was named Uzzah. This is Haftorah, so many of you will know it. It's the Haftorah of the story in the Torah where Nadav and Avihu, right? The man's name is Avinadav, right? And it's a story where Nadav and Avihu die for getting too close to God. And the Haftorah, for that Torah reading, grabs on to this issue where the Aron begins to slip and Uzzah just reacts without, you know, the stories are not exactly the same because Nadav and Avihu had some time to ask, is this the proper fire to bring? Are we doing the right thing? They have an uncle, they have a father, they can ask questions. But Uzzah acted on impulse. So he pushed the Aron from falling, and immediately he died. So Rashi says something fascinating. He says that Uzzah died, this is in the Pasuk, Al-Hashar. Hashar means he forgot. What did he forget? He said, Uzzah, the Aron carried the Kohanim across the Yarden, Sefer Yahushua. Surely it can carry itself. Somebody comment on this Rashi. He didn't make it up. It's a psikta, and it's also a Gemara. Rashi, Radak disagrees with that. Maybe Uzzah held like the Radak. And even if he held like Rashi, right, he acted on impulse. If I drop something in front of you, your first reaction is to reach out to pick it up. Maybe if he had a few questions, a few moments to ask a Shiloh, he said, oh, Rebbe, what should I do? By that time, the urn might be on the floor. But it's probably the answer that most of you have heard when in school. Yerushalmi in Maseches Sota says a fascinating explanation. I don't know if I were on tape, but it's Yerushalmi. What can I say? Yerushalmi says that there was a long trip from his house to Yerushalayim. They're walking on the sides. Maybe he had a couple of cups of coffee before he left. He had a nature called. And there's this big procession. Thousands of people are walking behind the Aron, and he's on one side and says, this is a great kavod. What should he do? Do we stop the procession? Should I go off myself and go off to the side? Yerushalmi says that he took care of nature right there in front of the Aron. There's no hint in the text that this is so. It's just an example of the rabbis telling us, okay, we have a tradition, this is what he did to die. Right? In other words, he was acting in an insolent manner, but all right, but this is what... Okay, I would like to suggest an explanation of why he died that I of course, will try to prove from the text itself. And it takes a minute or two. It is based on a syndrome known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Have you ever heard of what this is? It's a very, very common in the medical field, and that's for sure, but there are some parents that have been known to have this. What is it? It's that you want so much to be considered heroic that you, by proxy, means you put a problem onto someone else in order to be rewarded and acknowledged as a hero for solving that person's problem. If it's just Munchausen's, not by proxy, the person puts the problem on himself, him or herself, and then somehow wants pity for that problem. So Munchausen's by proxy is often, you know, they found a nurse, a male nurse in New Jersey, who killed 17 patients before he was caught. He puts in the wrong medication, he puts the medication too fast or too slowly, and then when the person goes into convulsions, the doctors don't know what's going on, and then he rushes in and says, no, this is coming in too fast, and he shuts it down. And the family says, oh my goodness, you saved his life. How could you know that? So when they made a forensic study and they saw all these patients were dying on his watch. So they put in the camera and they saw that he was doing. He was changing things around to be the rewarded. And the firefighters, you see this sometimes. A person starts the fire so that he can be the one that comes in. And so now, when the Pasuk describes what Uzzah did, it says, Uzzah pushed forth his hand to push the arrow because it started to slip. Now, I would have told that differently. I would have written in the text, he was walking by the side, the arrow started to slip, and Uzzah pushed it up. Why does it say that he first did an action and then telling us only afterwards why that was so? Again, we see what I'm doing. I'm protecting God at the expense of Uzzah. Maybe that's not good either. Eov's friends didn't like that either. But there's no rational explanation why God would take Uzzah's life and make this, number six, impediment to David's plans of bringing the Aron back to Yerushalayim. It ended up not going. He did not take it to Yerushalayim. He left it. And the celebration of bringing the Aron to my new city was stalled. Okay. At that point, some months later, when David finally did bring the arrow back, he was dancing so profusely before it that Michal came out to him and said, "You don't know how to behave as king. My father would never behave that way. How dare you dance?" The text says he was mecharker, which means to dance profusely. But when she's looking at him, it says, and Michal watched, this is the narrator talking, and she saw that David was mifazez u'mecharker. It uses an unusual word that describes out. I mean, he was like breakdancing, getting out, really over the place. But, she's like Queen Elizabeth. I'm the daughter of a king, I'm the wife of a king, I'm the sister of a king. And to see a king, my husband, should dance like a shugana like that? And David just said, v'sichachti lifnei Hashem. When the Rambam at the end of Hilchos Lulav talks about Simchas Beis HaShoeva and the rabbi dancing for a chasen and a kallah, he says, let loose, put on, do whatever you want. And if someone comes up to you and say, your stuffed shirt says to you, you're a rabbi, what are you doing? Are you greater than David HaMelech? The sichakti lifnei chasen v'kallah. What are you talking about? So the Rambam quotes this story with David. And the impediment is answered, but poor Uzzah didn't get to see it. David brings the Aron safely to Yerushalayim. The next step, of course, is to build a place for this Aron. David says, look at this, the Aron is surrounded by a curtain, and I live in a grand palace. He calls it Nosam HaNavi to build a base HaMikdash, to offer to build a house for the Aron. Now, most people would not be able to record what happens now. Because Nosam tells him, this is Reach Shmuel Bet Perek Zion, David, you are successful with whatever you do. You will be able to do this. You will build God's temple. Then open up, and that's what it says. Most people skip over that part and just go straight to the fact that in the morning, Nosam comes back to David and tells him, sorry, I made a mistake. And David reacted in a very magnanimous manner. Magnanimous means that he had reason to be very upset with the prophet. Your prophet, how did you not know this? I went to sleep last night, so it's such an exhilarating night for me, thinking that I'm going to change the course of Jewish history. For 500 years we've been living in Israel, no temple, I'm going to finally build one? And now you tell me I can't? And David doesn't even ask why. And you know what? The prophet doesn't tell him why. Does anybody in this room know why David didn't build a temple? Quote me the quote in Tanakh. Dav larov shafachta. You spilled much blood. Not that you're a warrior. That David fought wars for God does not invalidate him from building a temple. It's a moment. If a Kohen even accidentally kills a person in a car, he may never duchen for the rest of his life. A Kohen who took a life may not duchen. According to Sfardim, never. According to Ashkenazim, there's some role of tshuva to figure out how to do it. But a Kohen who takes a life may never do it. But a Kohen who kills an enemy in battle, even hand to hand, in a gruesome way, may do it in 10 minutes. Killing someone in battle is not an invalidation for building the temple, or duchening for that matter. Because if we need people fighting God's battles. It's not, nowhere does it say, David, you fought battles, and you're a warrior, you can't build a temple. says, Dom la Rosha Fakta, which is what everyone takes to mean, you fought many wars. That's not what it means. At least not according to a Brahmana. But in Shmuel, the reason I just gave appears in Divrei Hayomim. Not in Shmuel Bet. In Shmuel Bet, the prophet just tells him, sorry, David, I made a mistake. I told you last night that you will build the temple. You can't build the temple. Your son will build the temple. David is very magnanimous. From this, the Gemara learns that a person is never jealous of their child, because what my child achieves is my grandeur. Some even might like it more. It's better that my child should build the temple than I do. But what was the Dom la Rov Shafachta? Abravanel says something amazing. Uriah, the Dom la Rov Shafachta is that David, you know why I thought you would be able to build the temple? Because I'm a prophet. I looked and I said, oh yeah, of course, you're going to build the temple. But you know what? When he went to him the next day, David might have asked, why can't I build the temple? Why did you think I could last night? The answer the prophet would have told him is, I don't know why you can't build the temple. I'm not telling you because I don't know why. And the Bravanel says, this will not go for chairs, because the reason why David couldn't build the temple, he didn't do it yet. Well, how could God judge him on building the temple but of something he hasn't done yet? The Dom la Rov Shafachta is killing Uriah and the 50 men who went down with him. Dom la Rov Shafachta. You took Uriah's life. If David had exercised his free will the day he saw Bathsheba, chapter 11, and chose not to take her, and chose not to kill her husband, the prophet would have come the next day, says Abravanel, and says, David, God changed his mind, you will build the temple. But God knowing, God never tells this to the prophet, it's only in Divrei Hayomim, a book written 800 years later. God, let's say 600 years later. God tells him that tell him he can't build it. Because if you tell him why, he can't. Human being can't. I'm not even going to mix around with that. I know the future, so his request now does not fit in with what I know he will do. He will still have the free will not to do it. And if he exercises that free will, you go back to him in chapter 11 and tell him, you can't build it. Right? But now, don't tell him. Because you don't know it, and I'm not telling you why. Just tell him he can't. All right? So when he says Dom la Rov Shafachta, Bravanel says it's the Dom of Uriah and the 50 men who were killed with him. But David responds in a very magnanimous way. He doesn't even ask why. He's thrilled that his son will do it. That's fine with me. In chapter 8, David is pugilistic. A pugilist is a boxer. He is extremely cruel in chapter 8. He dispatches whatever remaining nation exists in his path of creating a peaceful kingdom for his son. He kills prisoners of war. He acts in chapter 8 in ways that are Rashi asks, why the horrible cruelty in chapter 8? Rashi gives explanations for what those nations did to him, especially Moab, where he comes from. His great-grandmother was from Moab. Because in Shmuel Aleph, remember I told you before that Shaul would use David's family as hostages and say, give yourself up or I'll start killing them one by one? So David took his family to Moab. This is not a Medrash, this is in Shmuel Aleph. And David tells them, when it is safe, I will send for you and bring you back to Israel. Rashi writes this in chapter 8. He'll refer to it again in chapter 10. And he says, we don't see in Shmuel Bet that David ever invited them back home. When David was king, certainly it's safe now to bring them back home. Why doesn't he ever bring them back home? The answer you might say is he did bring them back home. It just doesn't say so. Rashi doesn't go there. Instead, Rashi cites a Gemara that says that the king of Moab killed all of David's, killed his parents, all his siblings, and only one sister survived. Her name was Avigayo. A sister, he ended up marrying a woman with that name, but a sister named Avigayo survived. Right? She is called in Divrei Hayamim the daughter of Nochosh, who was the king of Ammon, who saved her life. Ammonite king saved one of David's siblings and allowed her to be brought back home. That's why David acted in such a pugilistic manner in chapter 8, to avenge his family and anyone who helped in the death of his family. It's a very short chapter, the shortest chapter in Shmuel Bet, and at the end, it gives David's cabinet. This is a political statement of sorts. David's cabinet helped him run the country. Four men. If you read in chapter 4 of Melachim Aleph, of Shlomo's cabinet, who helped him run the country. It's a whole chapter of a very bloated government. I say that because what brought down Shlomo's government was where the people tell him in chapter 11 of Melachim Aleph, and I'm going ahead a little bit, in chapter 11 of Melachim Aleph, the people said, Shlomo, you're charging too much taxes. If you lower the taxes, we'll serve you, but if you keep them as they are, we will rebel and appoint another king. And you know what he did. So he said, I'll even raise taxes on my father. And they rebelled and appointed Yeravam ben Nevat, and history changed for the Jews. But we see that David in chapter 8, he fought off the other kings, established a cabinet for his own kingdom, and in chapter 9, he offers recompense. He says, let me do something for the house of Shaul. I promised the house of Shaul that I would take care of his grandchildren. And in fact, when one of the times when David shows Shaul, I could have killed you. You see this garment here? I could have killed you. Right? So Shaul said, oh my goodness, I know now that you'll be king one day. Just promise me you won't kill my grandchildren. So David said, what are you talking about? How many times do I have to tell you I don't expect to be king one day? He was lying. He does expect to be king. But he wants to tell Shaul, I don't have any intention to become king. So this story happened again another time, when David took his canteen and his spear where Shaul was sleeping, and he showed him over the other side of the mountain. Shaul, how did I get this spear in this canteen? Isn't it yours? And he said, is that you, David? He couldn't even see him there. And he said, yes, look at this. And he showed him and he goes, David, now I know for sure that you will become king. Promise me again that you won't kill my grandchildren when you become king. And this time David let his guard down. He said, I promise. I will not kill your grandchildren when I become king. Then Shaul went ballistic. He said, he so turned to his men, he said, see, I told you, he does expect to become king. Let's go kill him. So the reason why I'm telling you this part is because the beginning of the chapter says, David wanted to keep his promise that he made to to Yonatan, to look after Yonatan's children. And then he made a promise to Shaul. Yonatan's children happened to be Shaul's grandchildren, but not all of his grandchildren. But in the end, Shaul went back on that promise because he kept on chasing him to David afterwards. Right? Made him go to the Plishtim. But David did make a promise, remember with those arrows, Machar Kodesh, that he'll look after Yonatan's children, and that will come back to us in chapter 24. Alright, so he looks for recompense, and he finds one descendant of Shaul. His name is Mephibosheth. Right? He is the son of Yonatan. And what is it? Remember, he is a particular impediment, he's crippled. When the Philistines killed off Shaul, Yonatan's son, whose nursemaid carried off as an infant, and she dropped him and fell on the floor, and he didn't have any way of setting his legs, and he grew up crippled. So David finds out where this boy is. Now, wait a second. Mephibosheth ben Yonatan is David's nephew. It's his wife's brother's son. How does he not know where his nephew is? Does anybody here have a nephew where you don't know where he is? How could you not know your nephew? You're the king. Right? So the answer is, says the Radak, that Mephibosheth thought that David wanted to kill him. He would be wrong. He would be as wrong as Rechav and Baana, who handed him the head of Ishbosheth, saying that David is going to be happy with this. He would be wrong in thinking that David wants him dead. But it's very common when a new king comes into power, what does he do to every single descendant of the previous king? You know. So Mephibosheth might have thought David would want to do that. He would be wrong. Look what David does. He wants to give him recompense to keep his promise that he made to this boy's father. And he gives him great honors, and that's what chapter 9 is about. Chapter 10. That king who saved David's sister, named Abigail, that king, his name was Nachash, that king died. David says, you know, this king helped me, doesn't say in Tanakh what he did. What I told you about saving David's sister is in the Medrash, right? He just says, this king helped me, let me return the favor to his son. I will send a delegation for a state funeral. David sent two men to attend the funeral of Nachash. His son was Hanun. Hanun's men, these are Ammonites, Hanun's men say, why are you accepting these two men from David? They're probably here on a spy mission to see the inner goings of your kingdom so he can come and wipe you out. So what did they do to them? They cut off half their beards, they cut off their pants, and sent them out to go home that way. Now, this is absurd. Since the beginning of time, the punishment for spying is always death. You don't send them home in shame to report what you think they came to find out. Right? Oh, so they reported without pants. So they got to go home and give the report with stupidity. Rather, what the Mephoshim say, what Amnon wanted was a fight with David. But what Amnon wanted, and this continues to be the case in the world today, was for the world to think that David picked the fight. I want to fight him, but I don't want to be seen as the aggressor. Right? Right? So we always know we can do anything we want against them, knowing that what they do in return, that's when the CNN crews will come in, and that's when they'll say, oh, Israel is a disproportionate response, etc., etc. So Amnon starts by shaming these men, and they come home the way they come home. David is incensed, and David goes to battle. The Tanchuma in Parshas Pinchas says an amazing thing. He says, David, a small sin always turns to a big sin. The Torah says, Lo tidrosh l'shlomam b'tova sam adolam. Do not seek the peace of Ammon and Moab. Why did you seek the peace of the king of Ammon? Don't you know that bad things will happen from this? Look at the snowball effect. Small sin, you sought peace of Ammon, and what happened? You went to battle. And what happened in that battle? David acted in an impulsive way. First, the king of Ammon acted with great insolence towards David and his treatment of his two men, and David acted in a very impulsive way. Because his men were in battle against Ammon, David used to go out to battle. This one time, he stays home in the palace. All the men are at war, and David is taking a stroll on his palace. Remember, David's palace is up on the hill. Everyone else lives below. And he's taking a stroll, which he's allowed to do on his patio. And he sees, while he's on his path, his God, he sees a woman dead. So David, if Uriah wasn't away at battle, there would never have been this problem with Bathsheba. A small sin sending peace to the Ammonites blew up into why you can't build the temple. Dam l'rov shafachta. Not to mention everything else that happened in the Bathsheba story. So, and David acted on impulse. Why do I use this word to describe chapter 11? Because in the storyline where there's a parable told in chapter 12 of what David did with Bathsheba, the prophet, in a very clever speech, he says, there's a rich man and a poor man in your kingdom. The rich man has many sheep, thousands of sheep, and the poor man just has a rosh ein kol, just has one sheep, and he describes in great detail how much he loves this sheep. Raises it, he stays with his kids, he eats at his table. Really, some strange things about how much he loves this sheep. That might be crucial to the story that he loves the sheep. Because what the text seems to make it a point that Uriah and Bathsheba had a very bad marriage. Right? Because David sends him home numerous times, he doesn't go home. I miss my wife when I'm not with her. She has to be here, full disclosure. But if I don't see her for a few hours, I can't wait to get home. You've been away for 8 months. The king tells you, go home and see your wife, and he chooses to sleep on the street? How do you not go home? I understand you're very loyal to your men. You don't want to have comfort while your men are in battle. But the king told you to go home. Right? But the fact is, it doesn't matter. Right? Anyway, in the parable, it says the man loved his one lone sheep. So listen, this very carefully. The rich man had a halech that came over to his house. He refused to take any of his own sheep to feed the oreach who came by. Instead, he took the one lone sheep of the poor man to give to the ish habayil. It's all one passage. Verse 4, chapter 12, refers to this guest. Three different words in the same passage. Halech, oreach, ish. A passerby, a guest, an honorable man. The rich man is David. The poor man is... The many sheep are David's many wives. The one sheep of the poor man is Bathsheba. Who's the guest? Why is my word for 11 impulsive? Who's the guest? That which makes the rich man want to take the poor man's sheep. What is it? The Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara starts off as a halach. It runs through your head and it goes, okay... When it's just a halach, a passerby comes to your door, he says, sorry, I'm not interested. You close the door in a second on a halach. An oreach, you invite it. Some people invite the oreach. They know full well what they're doing. They purposely go to this place to excite the Azar, right? It's all right. If you come in for a minute, all right, finish. Okay, it's over. Whether it's the Azar for gambling, for liquor, for whatever else it is. And the HR will be able to be pushed away more by a person with temperance. But if you're acting on impulse, and you're acting impulsively, and you're used to getting what you want, woe betide the HR, especially when you make it an ish. An ish, you didn't just invite him. An ish is paying rent. An ish lives in your house. Right? So the prophet very cleverly puts this together and doesn't finish off the parable the way it is, because the rich man should have killed the poor man after taking his sheep with what David did. Right? But then David would have recognized it right away. The prophet wants David not to recognize who it is and to pass judgment. And he says, Chai Hashem ki ben momis ha'ishal sezos. The man who did this cruel thing should die, and he should lose, and he should pay fourfold for the sheep. All kinds of violations of Torah law and the way David responded to this. The Gemara in Yuma says, oh, yeah, really, David? Chayecha, you're going to lose four children in your lifetime. Right? The baby from this union, Avshalom, Amnon, and the two opinions who the fourth is, whether it's Adoniah, who technically died right after David, or Tamar, who Medrash says committed suicide after Amnon violated her. We'll get into that shortly. So 11 is impulsive because David acted in an impulsive manner here. He should have looked at, saw that, oh my goodness, it's a halach. I shouldn't have seen that. He's allowed to walk on his God. But when the Gemara explains that she was bathing, she was actually going to the mikveh. How do we know that? Because when David took her in, it says, Vehin niskadeshes mitumasah. She was not a nida at the time. So the Barvanel says, look, if he's committing adultery, and I don't know, ask a question. A frum person is committing adultery. Some frum people committing, I don't know. Do they make sure that she went to the mikveh first? You're doing Mrs. Bezdin. Are you to clear away Yisr Karis? Why does the text tell me that she wasn't a nida? Right? So anyway, we all know when Chazal have the various excuses for what's going on here, but still David acted in an impulsive manner, and he suffers the rest of Shmuel Bet for two basic violations. One is that you broke up a family, and two, you used the sword of Amon in doing so. For the rest of Shmuel Bet, your family will be dysfunctional, and you will be chased by the sword. Sometime it'll be the same. Sometime it'll be someone in your family who's chasing you. Right? So that takes us to 13. Accusative was the prophet that accuses David and says, you say that a man should be killed and he should lose four sheep? Atoish! You're the man! Recognize it! Now, I must tell you, in any other country in the ancient world, no prophet, no high priest, no one can point the finger at the king who bears 100% absolute right over every life in his kingdom, and no one can point a finger to the king and say you did something wrong and go on to rebuke him. This, I know you can all say what you want about what David does in this story, but the fact that he allows the prophet to be accusative and he accepts it and says Chotasi is so different from every other nation in the ancient world. No one can tell a king that speak the way Nathan speaks to him. David did a terrible thing. Maybe he deserved to die for it. The text seems to say so. The prophet tells him, Gam Hashem ha'aviris chatosecha lo tamus. God will bear your iniquity. You will not die. Implying that you should. But you won't. I want to see what kind of tshuva you're going to do. David, for the rest of his life, felt that now maybe my son won't build the temple. There are prokimans in him that seem to indicate so. Until the prophet says, your tshuva was so great, you suffered so much, that not only will your son build the temple, her son will. Right? The son you have with her will build the temple. Right? That's Shlomo. Okay, so the rest is really going to go very quickly. I'm sure you hope. 13 is repulsive because to start fulfilling the promises of what the prophet tells him, the two things that will happen to you, is the first thing is repulsive. A son of David violates, he rapes the daughter of David. That's, again, internal dysfunction. Right? That's Amnon who behaves in a terribly repulsive way with his sister. Right, in 14, that sister has a half-brother named Avshalom. Remember, David has a whole host of children. The oldest is Amnon. He expects to become the next king. Anything that can be done by a younger brother to get rid of an older brother who pretends to get to the throne before me, any excuse he can use to get rid of him, Avshalom is next in line. Full disclosure, there is another one next in line. Its name is Kilov. He's never found in Shmuel Bet, which Chazal love. Kilov was Shlomo's Rebbe in Torah, in the beginning of Maseches Brachos, and he is one of four people, according to the rabbis, who never sinned. Binyamin, Amram, Yishai, and Kilov. This unknown son of David. Why do rabbis love him so much? because he's right in the thick of things. He's David's second son, but he's never in the competition to be the next king. But Avshalom sure is. When Hashem told David, "You can't build this temple, but your son, who will be a man of peace, will." Right? That's the way it appears in Divrei Hayamim. So, what's Avshalom's name? Avshalom. Peace is in my name. All right, but you're going to have a brother whose name even has more peace. His name is Shlomo. Right? So Avshalom takes this advantage of what Amnon did to kill off his brother, which he does, but then he's expelled from the nation. That's expulsion number 14. And he has to spend 2 years in exile, in which he is planning an insurrection. That we all know, that's called Mered Avshalom. It takes up the whole, really, I could just say each one word. And this insurrection did not necessarily start to kill his father. It was an insurrection to assure that he would be the next king. It was Achitophel, Avshalom's advisor, that turned it to be violent against David. Right? Avshalom never wanted to kill David. He just wants to make sure that David, you appoint me. I'm the man of peace you're talking about. Make me the next king. But Achitophel, who despises David, convinces Avshalom to act in a manner, or can only be described as a manner of revulsion. Mm-hmm. What Avshalom is told to do is to take David's 10 remaining women. Mm-hmm. David was forced to flee Yerushalayim, to escape across the Yarden, barefoot, it says. David did a full tshuva here, right? And he left 10 women in charge of the palace. Avshalom took these 10 women, his wives, took them up to the same, it says in the text, the same God that he saw at Bathsheba at the beginning, if you think of the irony, and he violated all 10 of them in front of his son. Because the prophet told him, "You did this secretly. No one in Israel really knows what you did, actually. You look good at the end of the story, just like that rich man looks good feeding a stranger and someone else's sheep. You look good. You took in a widow, right? You took in a war widow after us. No one knows that you sent him to die. Right? You did it secretly. Your women will be taken in front of the sun for everyone to see." And that's what Avshalom does in a manner of terrible revulsion, so everyone can see this boy isn't rebelling against a brother. He's rebelling against his father. Right? And then Achitophel convinces him the only way you'll be the next king is if you actually kill your father. And go tonight. He's crossed the Yarden. He's weak. Go tonight. At the same time, amazing story of espionage, chapter 17. A man named Hushai Ha'arki escaped. He's sent from David's camp to go back to Yerushalayim and report to Avshalom. "Avshalom, I want to come to your side." And Avshalom, in a case of the kettle calling the pan black, he says, "How dare you rebel against my father? What kind of friend are you? You were his closest friend. How are you rebelling against him?" Wanted to vet him out, the same way that Avshalom was supposed to vet out Avner back in chapter 3. So, in a case of a beautiful case of a double agent, Hushai Ha'arki says, "Listen, I know I love your father, but I want to be with the winner. I can see your father is not going to outlast this. He is very strong right now, but it seems to me, the stories I'm hearing, is that you're going to win this. And I want to be on the side of the winner." So Avshalom says, "Okay, come, I want to have a strategy session. Achitophel says that I should go tonight to kill your father." And he says, no, I just came from the camp. That is a bad idea. If you go tonight, he is waiting for you and he will destroy you." He brings in Achitophel and he says, "The Tanakh says that if you ask Achitophel advice, it's like you're asking the Urim B'Tumim. He's always right." And Achitophel says, "No, what are you talking about? He just walked across the Yarden. He's weak. This is the time to get him." And Hushai Ha'arki said, "Ribono Shel Olam," he said, "I was just there, right? I saw it. How can you tell me what you think is right when I just came from there? I want to side with the winner, and I'm coming to give you good advice. If you go tonight, your whole rebellion will be wiped out." It says that David said a prayer just at this time, "Ribono Shel Olam, please make Achitophel's advice seem foolish in the eyes of Avshalom." He didn't say, "Please make Achitophel give bad advice." Achitophel gave actually good advice. "Go now to kill your father," in terms of what Avshalom wanted to do. Right? In other words, if someone says, "Listen, I want to rob a bank, can you give me the best advice?" Good, the best advice would be, "Don't rob a bank." But if he really wants to get that's his initiative, so the initiative is here. Achitophel gives him what is better advice in terms of being the next king. But Avshalom finds it foolish, and he says, "Achitophel, I have to go with the man who just came from there. Right? So Husharp, he gets the job done. He gets him not to go that time. Husharp, he escapes and makes his way back to David to say, David, I bought you a little time. You have to really now bring up the forces. All right? But it says in the Tanakh that had he gone that night, he would have wiped David out right away. When Ahitophel saw that he did not follow his advice, he hanged himself. He knew that if he's not taking my advice, this insurrection will fail, and the first thing David will do when he catches me is he'll kill me. Better I should take my own life, and at least my children will inherit me, than that the king should kill me, and then he'll inherit me. So he's a sore loser, yeah, but I understand why he did it. As soon as he saw that Avshalom did not go that night, and that the espionage of Hushai Ha'arki worked, he, double agent, he killed himself. There was a Pyrrhic victory. It's a terminology taken from an actual war, where you win the war, but you lose the battle, and you win the battle, but you lose the war. What's the nature of the Pyrrhic victory? David did win this battle. Avshalom was killed, though. And David wanted Avshalom alive. He is still my son. I remember bouncing on my leg, and he gave the order to everybody, don't kill him. I want him taken alive. Yoav caught, found him hanging from when his head was caught in the tree. His hair was caught in the tree. Now, obviously, if your head gets caught in the thicket, you can imagine, take out a sword and start slicing it, start cutting it. But he loved his hair. Remember, Avshalom, it says earlier that his hair, he used to weigh it, and he used to braid it, and he loved his hair. He didn't want to cut his hair, it was so vain. So while he was maneuvering and trying to get his hair out, Yoav caught him and clubbed him to death through arts and darts and arrows, and he died a violent death he deserved. When David hears of this Pyrrhic victory, right, he cries from his balcony in front of the people that just risked their lives to go with him out of Yerushalayim, and David cries for him, but redemption does indeed come. And David's plan at redemption and rebuilding, called reconstruction, like after the Civil War, is to appoint, get this, to appoint Avshalom's head of the army, his name was Amasa, to now run his own army. That is akin to the Union making Robert E. Lee whoever else you want, to head Union forces after the Civil War. Who thinks that this is a terrible idea? Yoav again. Don't get in Yoav's way in this book, guys. Right? There is another mutiny after this. His name is Sheva ben Bichri. Someone from Sheva ben Yamin. Sheva ben Bichri holds himself up in a town, and he says, I'm going to start a mutiny and take over the kingdom from this town. And David dispatches Amasa to take care of the mutiny. And Amasa doesn't show up. And Yoav tells David, I told you, David, just like you did with Avner. This is a bad idea. How can you make Amasa? So really what David was doing is he was replacing Yoav because you killed my son. Why didn't David just kill Yoav already? Yoav is throughout the book getting David in trouble. Why didn't he just kill him? There's two good reasons. One is Yoav is David's sister's son. I said that at the beginning. Remember that Asael was David's nephew. Yoav, his brother, is also his nephew. So his sister probably stepped in each time that David might have wanted to kill Yoav. But now I've had enough. You killed Avshalom. I gave a specific command not to. Right? But Yoav has something on David that makes it so that David in his lifetime has nothing to do to him. He gets even with Yoav on his deathbed. He tells Shlomo, listen, Shlomo, I couldn't do anything to Yoav. I don't even want to tell you why I couldn't. He doesn't tell him why. But you take care of him. He doesn't have anything on you. What does Yoav have on David? I didn't say it, actually. He's the one who knows that David sent for Uriah to be killed. Right? Now, Uriah is not just some soldier. Uriah is listed as one of David's 37 chief generals. And David commands an army with over a million. There's one battle where David fights with 1,100,000 soldiers. Yoav is Uriah is a trained, is a very special force soldier. And so that when he calls him home from battle to report, Uriah doesn't think, why are you calling me? What do you have to do with me? He understood why he's being called home. He's an important person, right? So when Amasa does not show up on time for this mutiny to take care of this mutiny, Yoav dispatches him, but David again doesn't do anything because of this, because Yoav has some goods on him. Maybe he told David, listen, if I die a violent death, my son knows exactly where there's a box with some information in there, and he'll spread it around Israel, and you're not going to want that. So don't touch me. All right? Later, a prophet wrote the story that appears in Tanakh. The Gemara at the end of Sanhedrin says that David begged God, why don't you just keep it out of Tanakh? Why don't people have to read about what I did with Bathsheba? So Hashem says, because I want them to read about what you did wrong and how you did tshuva, and it's important for me to have it in the Bible. So David said, at least make it just be written once. It's not in Divrei Hayyamim. Divrei Hayyamim has every aspect of David's life except Bathsheba. The whole story of Bathsheba does not appear in Divrei Hayyamim at all. Okay, so let me just finish this off. And this mutiny is put down finally. But Yoav does kill Amasa for not taking care of it on time. Right, and then if you recall in Haftorah just a few weeks ago, Parashas Vayechi, where David tells Shlomo, listen, you don't let Yoav die, an old man. Kill him because he killed Yoav. He killed Avner and he killed Amasa. Right? He doesn't say because he killed Avshalom, your brother. Somehow he doesn't want to mention Avshalom at that point. But he says because he killed Avner and he killed Amasa, two people more righteous than he. Okay, finally, let's just finish off. 21 is that there is a famine for 3 years in a row, and David inquires of God, how can I take care of this famine? And he says, there's some outstanding sin against the Givonim, and unless you atone for that sin, this famine will continue. David goes over to the Givonim and says, what's the problem? Why are you against us? Why is God angry with us because of something that happened to you? And the Givonim respond to something that's just not written in the Bible. The Givonim say, because Shaul shed blood amongst our people, and we want revenge for this. It doesn't say in Tanakh what Shaul ever did to the Givonim. It says in Tanakh what Shaul did to the people of Noah. He destroyed the city of Kohanim because they helped David. So if we turn back to Sefer Yehoshua, and it says that Yehoshua, because the Givonim tricked him into a peace pact, right? He said, you will be water carriers and woodcutters for the Kohanim. So we can maybe interpolate and say that when Shaul killed off the house of the Kohanim, he also killed off some Givonim. In the very least, he took away their resources and their occupation. So Gemara in Yevamos says that it was David's way of showing that God cares more about converts than about Kohanim. Because surely, if Shaul did something terrible and despicable to deserve such a famine, it should be more than what he did to the Kohanim. Yeah, but Kohanim are atoned. We atoned, that's part of our nation. But what he did to the Givonim, that has not been atoned. So what did the Givonim ask? Seven descendants of Shaul want to hang them publicly. And David said, Ani Etein, it's one of the most difficult portions of the Tanakh. And my word is vicarious, because vicarious is where we punish one person for the sin of another person. In the Code of Hammurabi, there's vicarious punishment. If I kill my neighbor's son, Chas v'Shalom, my son gets killed, not me. That's the Code of Hammurabi, vicarious punishment. How can you punish these seven because of something that Shaul did to the Givonim? But then David gave them over, and the famine ended afterwards. It's an amazing story. But David, it says, remember I told you I would come back to this later, is that in chapter 21, it says that David purposely did not take any children of Yonatan because he promised that he'll look after them. But these were grandchildren of Shaul. But David was not bound by the promise he made, I won't kill your grandchildren after you die, because Shaul went back on his part of the deal. Shaul said, I won't chase after you anymore. Just promise me you won't kill my grandchildren after you become king. So when Shaul continued to chase after him, David was not bound on his promise. So in chapter 9, when he recompensed, he says, let me keep my promise to Yonatan, not my promise to Shaul. So here he gave over seven descendants of Shaul, and as soon as they were hanged, and it says that Ritzpah, that woman Ritzpah, back in chapter 4, whom Avner was accused of sleeping with, this woman Ritzpah took care of the bodies and made sure that no vultures came to them. Okay, it was a reminder, says the Gemara, how much God cares for these converts from Givon. Chapter 22 and 23, I've had melodic and euphonic. These are just two songs. These are lists of songs. And the list of some of David's soldiers and generals and some of David's heroic events. So melodic means that the melodies. In fact, chapter 22 is almost exactly chapter 18 of Tehillim. He liked it so much, he put it into Tehillim also. No? All right. But There are a few small differences between the two. Very famously, one enters our benching in Shmuel Bet. It says, Migdol Yeshuos Malko Ba'oseh Chesed L'mshicho. In Tehillim, it says, Magdil Yeshuos Malko. So someone wrote Shmuel Bet, and they thought it meant Shabbos. On Shabbos, we say Migdol. During the week, we say Magdil. All right, so the last one is enumerate, where David somehow gets it in his head that he has to count the Jews. There were over a million Jews living in Israel at the time. And he counts them, and Yoav says, David, why do you want to count them? You should have done that a thousand times for the amount of people you have. Don't make me do this. You're not supposed to count. Right? So this is there's a Gemara in Maseches Yuma that gives all the different reasons why you're not supposed to count, but it's very clear here, as the Gemara at the end of Maseches Brachos points out, that there's something wrong. What is the thing? It's Nayin Hara. Don't... All right, but there is, as a result of this enumeration, David is given three choices of sin. One is 3 days of pestilence. One is 3 months of famine, 3 years of famine, and one is to be chased by your enemies for 3 years. And David's, the response of David to these three choices is what we say every day at Tachanun. I am greatly distressed over this. Let me fall in the hands of God, meaning pestilence or famine. Let me not fall in the hands of my enemies. I had enough with my enemies already. So, David chooses the pestilence. Radak says he chose pestilence over famine because famine a king can survive. Pestilence, I put my lot with everyone else. Right? So, for the first few hours, it says that 70,000 people died in this pestilence. Until David stands before the angel of death, this is Pesukim in the Haggadah, and he says, kill me, I'm responsible. The angel tells him, go up to that mountain, purchase that land from the king who lives up there. His name is Aravna the Jebusite. And as soon as you purchase that land, offer an offering there, and then this will end. And he does so, buys the area known as Harabais, and then the anger departs, and the pestilence ends, and in a very inglorious way, so the Shmuel Bet. Just like that. It says he paid 50 shkalim for the land, and Divrei HaHamim says he paid 600 shkalim for the land. It's not inflation. He paid for Yehuda's land in Shmuel, and he collected money from all the other tribes, 11 other tribes, so that every tribe can feel a part of what's on Har Bayis, and that's how Shmuel Bayis ends. Divrei HaHamim has a very different picture of this time period. David prepares a great preparation with all the raw materials to build the Beit HaMikdash, and but Shmuel Bet's agenda is different. What would happen at the end of David's life because of what he did with Bathsheba? And Melachim continues that agenda. A very old king who's very frail, who needs Bathsheba to tell him what's happening. If not for her, who knows who would be the next king? But it's really to the credit of David, but the author of this book, that doesn't hold back on what happens to a king of Israel when he has a moral lapse. The purpose of the rest of the book after chapter 12 is to show how he suffered for that moral lapse, but didn't give in. And he made good for at least so that his son would build a temple, but that also her son would build a temple. And that may be why he set up a parak like this Moshir Chanukas HaBayis LeDavid. That when he realized that his son would still build the temple, and he was able to put together the raw materials, take his own 15 prokim and Divrei HaHamim about this, that he appreciated the fact that he didn't lose that gift. So I'm just going to run through the chapters. Doleful over Shaul's death, competitive to see which tribe is better capable of saving the people from the Philistines. Avner acted in a conciliatory manner to go over to David's side. And once that happened, the regicide was inevitable, the death of Ishbosheth. And in that case, David is capable of acting in an imperial manner because he is now king over all of the tribes. So the next thing to do is obviously to bring the Aron to that new city that he just conquered, called Yerushalayim. And now to bring the Aron there, but there's an impediment. It stopped on the way because of the story with Uzzah that I explained with that little novelty of Munchausen's. And then when he finally brought the Aron, he was accused by his wife of acting a little too crazy, but he spoke back to her and said that I'm just v'sichakti lifnei Hashem. So that impediment was put behind because he did bring the Aron to Yerushalayim. The next thing is, of course, to build a temple to put around this Aron. But he was rebuffed for reasons I mentioned before. The prophet doesn't tell him why because the prophet didn't know why. But David nonetheless acted in a magnanimous way because he heard that his son would do so, and the person is never jealous of his child. David had to finish off the battles, fighting all the other nations, especially Moab, and he acted in a very pugilistic way in doing so. And that's 8. David gives recompense to Shaul's remaining, Yonatan's remaining son, named Mephibosheth. But then in chapter 10, the king of Ammon dies, and David sends a peace mission to him, and he acts in the king of Ammon acts with insolence. Just to mention this before, but the Yeraim in chapter 250 in his book Sefer Yeraim justifies David. He says, "Lo sidrosh l'shlomam." You're not allowed to pursue the peace of Ammon, but David was returning a gesture of peace from Ammon because the king saved my sister. So I'm just returning, not this rosh l'shlomam. I'm not doing. I'm machzir shalom, which is allowed. David acts in an impulsive way when he sees Bathsheba on the roof. But, you know, David, that battle can't happen because you sent that instance of peace. And the prophet was accusative of him, which David accepted. But the rest of Shmuel Bet starts to be punishment for what David did. The first thing is the repulsive way that his son Amnon acted with his half-sister or stepsister Tamar. In which case, Avshalom responded by killing him, and he was expelled. The expulsion of Absalom from Israel, which started an insurrection, which led Achitophel to tell him to do something which was a manner of revulsion, to take your father's wives up to the roof and fulfill the prophet's prediction that you did something secretly, but the same thing will happen to you, but open to the sun. And Absalom probably would have killed David if he had taken Achitophel's advice, but thanks to the espionage of Hushai Ha'arki, double agent, who convinced Absalom, "Wait, I just came from your father's camp. He is waiting for you." That was not true. Had Absalom gone that night and taken Achitophel's advice, he would have killed him and been the next king. But thanks to Hashem hearing David's prayer, Achitophel preferred Hushai Ha'arki's report and then proceeded to kill himself. It was something of a Pyrrhic victory. Even though David won the battle, he lost his son, and then there was the redemption of the return to Jerusalem. That was followed by more problems. There was a mutiny of Sheba ben Bichri. David appointed the head of Avshalom's army, Amasa, to head his new army because he wanted to rebuke Yoav for killing Avshalom. And of course, don't get into Yoav's way in this book. When the mutiny wasn't put down immediately by Amasa, he just didn't show up. Yoav used it as an opportunity to prove to his king that it was a bad choice to choose Amasa, and he dispatched him. David behaves in a vicarious manner in chapter 21 by giving over 7 descendants of Shaul to atone for a sin of Shaul. 7 descendants of Shaul to atone for Shaul's sin. 22 and 23 are melodic and euphonic. That means that there's songs of David that are collected at the end of his life. Some of them even made their way into Tehillim. And then finally, they enumerate what David counts the Jews and the response that actually led to David atoning for what happened and buying Harabayas finally for the place where the temple would be built. So we assume that David would have been told to buy that place earlier had he been given permission to build this temple, but he was told not to, so he waits to the very end of his life to buy that place and make it a place that all the tribes would take part in. I think I went above my hour, so I appreciate that you stuck around.